Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable for this Tuesday. It is Tuesday, the 9th of June, and it's very nice to have you with us. A great pleasure to have you on with us, joining us for the program this morning. We have a wonderful panel for you. We are going to discuss many issues. I just want a quick shout out. The music this morning we're listening to is the Pointer Sisters. The founding member, Bonnie Pointer, of the Pointer Sisters died yesterday of cardiac arrest, 69 years old. Just one of the real greats, and we'll be playing Pointer Sisters music throughout the morning this morning. If you want to see and find the music, you can just go look at our playlist. It's posted online, wamc.org/roundtable, wamc.org/roundtable. All right, let's get started. And a reminder, you can join us, join in on the fun by simply writing us, panel@wamc.org. Let me get to everybody here. We'll start the introductions. WAMC's Alan Chartok joins us. Good morning, Alan. Hello, Alan. All right. We lost Alan. Well, we're doing well. We're doing great so far, aren't we, Rosemary?
Oh, I'm having a great time.
Can we play Jump again?
Can we play Jump again? Yeah.
Yeah. Let's go back to the music. That's before the show hit a... Okay, here we go. Investigative journalist and UAlbany adjunct professor Rosemary Armeo. Good morning, Rosemary.
Good morning.
How are you?
Jumping.
Excellent. Good to hear. We had her on Friday, and she was nice enough to come back, and we couldn't be more thrilled. UAlbany lecturer in Africana Studies, Jennifer Burns, is back. Good morning, Jennifer. How are you?
I'm good. Good morning, everyone. Glad to be here.
Well, great to have you. Thank you so much for being with us. And our old friend and our Tuesday regular and just the rock, Mike Spain, is here, former Times Union Associate Editor. Good morning, Mike. How is everything?
Oh, everything is just fine, Joe. Thank you.
Well, we'll
see. Happy to be here.
We'll see if it stays fine. We're going to try to get Alan back. So I will say, no, we're not going to try to get Alan back? Okay. So here's the thing. Alan is traveling, was traveling. He had a doctor's appointment. So I think he's like in the hills and valleys. But by 9:30, he'll be back to the studio and he'll be on with us. So we were thinking we could get him by phone. But if he's here, great. And if not, we'll have him at 9:30. So we all will get started and we'll bring in Alan as soon as it becomes available and he can join us, and that'll be terrific. Again, we welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. And we begin this morning with, a number of stories, but we'll start with the police reform bill. Democrats unveil broad police reform bill as Floyd's death sparks protest nationwide and continues to do so. We should note that the funeral of George Floyd and his burial will take place today. That is taking place, and we will be airing that, by the way, on HD2, and will also be available online. Alan, do we have you?
I hope so.
All right. Well, we'll have you there, and then you'll be home soon, and then we'll really have you. Yes. So that's good. We introduced.
I had to drive to Amsterdam for a test, and then 3 hours in the car, and I almost made it back in time, but I didn't. Sorry.
No, you're fine. Everything's good. Everything's good. You're here. We're all good. All right. So congressional Democrats rallied Monday around broad police reform legislation, urging President Trump and Republicans to rapidly embrace measures aimed at boosting law enforcement accountability, changing police practices, and curbing racial profiling. As Democrats put forward a unified response to the police killing of George Floyd in Minneapolis, which has sparked nationwide protests, leading members of the party also sought to distance themselves from the growing calls from liberal activists to defund the police, a slogan that Trump and fellow Republicans have seized upon to portray Democrats as weak on crime. Joe Biden, the presumptive Democratic presidential nominee, says he opposes defunding police departments, while House Speaker Nancy Pelosi said such decisions fall to local governments, as she and members of the Congressional Black Caucus touted their bill at a news conference yesterday. All right. Alan, we'll let you begin, and then we'll work around the room here.
Well, I think Biden is absolutely right. Now the people who are pushing defunding are saying it's not really defunding. But look, you've got to have police departments. The problem is you've got to make sure that those police departments are fair, just, and are not filled with prejudiced guys or women who are just outrageous. And to me, the name of the game is reform. It's not defunding. And I think Biden's right about that.
Jennifer Burns.
I agree. I don't think that we can just defund or I think we do need to dismantle aspects of the police department, especially in certain communities. But we also need the police to transition into protecting the people in different communities. And that's a shift away from what we have seen and what we have heard people voicing in inner city and in urban communities more than in other places.
So is it, how do you get, so it seems to me, Jennifer, and correct me if I'm wrong here, but it seems like a balancing act. And if it is, how do you get that mixture right?
It is a balancing act because, I mean, we have to be realistic, right? When we were talking last week and in many conversations, we were looking at even the peaceful protests and outsiders coming in and creating chaos, you know, and that's not to say that there weren't some people within the protest movement that were expressing their protest in ways that many other people did not agree with, you know, and that involves maybe some violence and some looting. But the key here is, you know, when people do come into communities and target them, we also need the police there to protect from that, right?
Right.
And so that is a key component to remember. And I think really it comes down to those examples where we really, you know, have to remember that the people in the communities know what they want and know what they need. And they also know what they don't want and what they don't need based on what they have experienced continuously for quite some time. And so in order to do it, I think you really need the input from the people in the community directly, not just what they don't want to see happening anymore. That information is, you know, very critical because then it indicates what has been going on and people haven't been paying attention to, but also the kind of police that they want, the you know, what kind of solutions and what they want their police forces to look like as partners in their communities. I think that's a key.
Yeah, that partner idea is so important and seems somewhat elusive sometimes, especially in the situations that we've seen over the last several weeks.
Hey, Joe.
Yes.
If I might, I just want to add one small caveat to what our distinguished guest Jennifer has just said, and that is, believe me, there have been small town police departments and small village police departments where there have been problems also, Jennifer. It really is a matter of the way that police feel about themselves more than anything else. So I would just make that small caveat. That's all.
Well, and I want to
hear an alternative view.
Let me just have Jennifer go to Alan, and then, yes, I do want to hear your view, Rosemary. Go ahead, Jennifer.
So I do agree with you. I think it is about how the police feel about themselves. But if you're right, if they have this, they are gods in this community and they know better. And if they have discriminatory racist ideas in their heads, right, then that's going to be played out even more. And you are right. This happens in other communities as well, and not on just, you know, African Americans. It happens in communities that are struggling in rural areas and other areas that aren't so struggling. Right. And so it does come down to the character of police. And that's when we get into that connection of poverty shaming or the superiority over economics in some of the minds of police officers. And then in largely black and brown communities, that poverty shaming idea with the racial component added. So two additional pieces in who those cops are. So I do agree.
Absolutely.
On that.
Absolutely. I do.
Now, for an alternative view, we go to Rosemary Arameo.
I think defund the police. We are in the middle of a very, very big movement. It feels like 1968. It feels like civil rights again. And we are wasting it if we just do minor reforms like banning chokeholds, which should have been done years ago, should not be done at the federal level. It should be done at the local level where you actually can look at the needs of each community and what they want. And it should be something bigger. And San Diego yesterday put an extra $27 million into the police department, a ridiculous action to take right now. Instead, why can't we look again at how police function? It's reform, but much bigger than reform. And it is defunding. It's taking money away from them to do things that they shouldn't be doing anyway. We need money for mental health training. We need money for social work. We need money for jobs programs for young people and summer programs. And that should come out of police budgets, because they seem to be spending it mostly on equipment to fight us in the streets. So Democrats are awful at messaging. And so to call this defund police brings up all the Joe Biden worries that people won't vote for us if I say get rid of police. Nobody really means, I think, get rid of police, although totally revamping how they operate and their relations to communities are what we're talking about. And there's energy and there's motion to do that right now. So I want to counter Trump, who's saying, yes, we're going to have great, strong police departments, and say defund them. Get them out. They're not working. We have to relook, not just at police departments, but I've even have to give credit to Bernie Sanders. He didn't say we're going to reform the healthcare system. He's going to say we're going to start something totally new, and he was right. And it's true about policing and social justice, too.
But Mike Spain, can a Democrat, and in this case Joe Biden, win if he embraces the argument of defund the police?
Not if he calls it defunding. I mean, if they ran that term by a focus group, it would have so many different reactions. What you're talking about is reapplying the funds that we're spending on public safety, training police, better recruiting of police, getting community police programs. You know, in communities where there's been, you know, the stop, walk, and talk type community policing, you've seen success. And it might go right down to the very hiring and selecting and training of police officers. It has to be done right. You need to get people in there who are going to understand what their role is and not just make them bigger and stronger. So, you know, to call it defunding, I think is terrible. It just gives Trump and law and order, proponents, people who say law and order proponents, police unions, it says they're attacking us. They want to take us down. They want to hurt us. You know, it's a lot like saying build the Pentagon, build the military to make the U.S. safe, when a fraction of that money spent on foreign aid, diplomacy, things like the Peace Corps, building democracies across the globe would cost a lot less, and then you wouldn't need so many military armaments. Well, the same thing goes for police. You won't need as many cops on the street if you have a better community, and spending some of that money that way makes sense. But calling it defunding police sounds punitive. It ignores that there's many, many, many good policemen and police officers and police departments, and there's many good programs that are successful across the country. And it just makes it sound like they're all bad. And then it just gets the unions backs up, and all the politicians are back the unions, and a lot of them do. And they're very influential, and it just creates an adversarial situation. It's taking on the wrong, verbiage. It really needs to be building better police departments and, you know, funding more appropriately.
Rosemary?
You know what?
Okay, go ahead, Alan.
Very quickly, I just want you to know that I think we're all basically on the same page. There is a matter of nomenclature here, obviously. That's a big issue, which is defund is a stupid thing to say because, you know, you need police. There's no question. Somebody comes to your house and something terrible happens, you're going to need to call a policeman. But how they behave, what they do, how respectful they are, that's another whole story. And whether they're prejudicial towards, you know, for example, blacks and browns.
Rosemary, we have about 90 seconds.
I think that some of it is nomenclature. There's no question. And Trump, of course, quickly turn defund police into dismantle police, which is really what we're debating. And that's not the issue. We should be looking at what's really needed, what is really needed, what kind of reforms, difference in training and recruiting, and really how to fund police so that they do protective services. I think that's what the professor said, and she's totally right about that. Rather than things that are social justice and improving economic conditions, they're not equipped to do that. They are definitely, they should not be doing it. Leave it to the experts.
What do you think is, so if we look at what the legislation that is moved, that was put forward by House Democrats yesterday, so where do we go from there? I mean, what traction does that get, if any? In other words, are we going to see
McConnell
any meaningful
will
reforms?
Let it go anywhere?
No.
Yeah. So, like I say, I think it's got to be done at the state level, and what's happening in the New York legislature this morning seems a whole lot more important to me. Wonderful reforms, long needed. Why it took the death of that man of George Floyd in Minneapolis, I don't know. But 50A will be repealed. There are state police are going to use cameras on their cars and on their bodies. These are reforms we should have had years ago.
And one last thing, Rosemary, and that is, if the Republicans still had the Senate, it wouldn't be happening. None of it would be happening.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we will continue with Alan Chartok, Mike Spain, Rosemary Armeo, and Jennifer Burns. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable for this ninth day of June. It is 34 minutes past 9 o'clock, and our panel made up of Alan Chartok, Mike Spain, Rosemary Armeo, and Jennifer Burns. We welcome your letters panel at WAMC.org. We have been talking about the package put forth by Democrats yesterday in the House and Senate. I do also want to bring into this conversation New York lawmakers looking to defy police unions and saying they want to ban chokeholds. We talked a little bit about this in some of our conversation earlier and skirted around it, but I would like to talk about it a little more directly. Inspired by the protests sweeping the state and nation, New York legislative leaders on Monday began to approve an expansive package of bills targeting police misconduct, defying longstanding opposition from law enforcement groups, including police unions. The measures range from a ban on the use of chokeholds to the repeal of an obscure decades-old statute that had effectively hidden the disciplinary records of police officers from public view, making it virtually impossible for victims to know whether a particular officer has a history of abuse. The proposal signify a turning point in Albany. Many of the policy changes being voted on this week languished for years because of opposition from influential police and corrections unions that contribute generously to the campaigns of elected officials. So how do we look at this? You know, Mike, when we think of Eric Garner's death in 2014, if you thought that there was a moment that perhaps action could have been taken, it could have been taken six years ago.
Yeah, it's people have been clamoring for 50A to be taken off the books and repealed for years, but not anybody in the legislature. Maybe a handful of lawmakers would propose it. It would, every year it would go nowhere. Garner's death showed the officer, Daniel Padalio, he had a history of being violent and breaking the rules, and that was all secret. Had that been known, how could he have been promoted? How could the police department have kept him on the force? How could they not deal with that if they had to face public scrutiny? But because it could be kept secret, they could just keep him there, and he kept his job, and then he was there that day in Staten Island, that fateful day for Eric Garner, and broke the rules and held it and used a chokehold that had been banned. That kind of officer should be off the street. If police were more accountable, you know, if police departments were more accountable to the public, that kind of thing wouldn't happen as much, I would presume. So,
you know,
it's amazing. It's amazing.
And Alan,
you know, when we were talking about that the other day, there were people who said maybe the unions would come around. And I said, are you kidding?
Not a bit. No
way. Are you kidding? It's good. They're going to redouble their efforts. Up until now, they have had I want to use this advisedly, a chokehold on the system. It's not funny, I guess, but it is so that they really were able to call all of the shots. I have a feeling that the big question now is what happens to these unions and whether or not the people in the legislature are going to have the guts to do what's right. It's interesting, though, as NPR pointed out this morning, both houses of the legislature have African-American leaders. And let me tell you, they're not backing down.
No. Rosemary, what do you make of this union question?
I think the unions are extremely too powerful, and they need to be taken down. I think that's part of the reform that we've been talking about. I'm all for protecting your employees, but they are blocking accountability, and they're keeping very incompetent people on forces, dangerous people. I actually have to tell you that I feel the same way about the Newspaper Guild, which would protect someone when they were charged, for example, plagiarism, which I have no truck with. If you commit plagiarism, you're out, and I don't care what the union says. But, you know, plagiarism doesn't kill somebody, and that's what police unions are doing. And they have had a tremendous amount of power because of our own fear, citizens' fear. They want protection. Trump and the Republicans know the power of saying law and order, and so they get anything. Joe Biden is taking abuse right now because he worked with police unions and officials on crime bills. But that's what everybody did, Republicans and Democrats. And that's why I'm saying this is a new time. Things have definitely changed. There's no going back, and the unions have to be broken.
Now, Joe, I know I'm talking too much, but there is a question here, and that is, it's not only on these issues of terrible issues of people, killing or maiming or doing or acting disrespectfully. It goes through the whole fabric of the department. Why, if you're in charge of a police department, are you going to discipline somebody for anything at all? Or even hold them accountable or even supervise them if you know you got the unions in your face.
Right. And that's a great point, Jennifer, because you can do these things and know that you have a sense of protection, right?
And I think the other thing here is what we're all trying to wrap our brains around is that police unions are trying to protect their employees, and their employees are responsible for enforcing the laws on the books. And so I think this comes down to shifting our focus and being creative again and looking at how do we change the law on the books so that the officers who are out there are enforcing laws where they're not involved in these kind of altercations that lead to, you know, death or other things, right? So I think unions could protect officers better if the responsibility of officers was revised, was clear, because then they'd be defending them for different things, right? Not for the things that they're trying to protect and defend them for now. So I think it comes down to really changing the engagement between the officers and the people with the laws on the streets themselves.
Mike, you touched on this, but what is in it for the unions to say, okay, we should keep chokeholds on the books?
Nothing. I think it's a broader thing. I think it had, by calling it one of the reasons that we have such large police departments and they've grown since the 90s was there was a lot of crime. You know, it was during the crack cocaine period and there was lots of street crime and it scared people. And that's when Biden basically bought the whole line of the police unions that we need more cops on the street. We need to fund more cops on the street. Then we'll have safe streets and America would be wonderful. Well, it didn't work out that way. And now when you say defunding, it means removing cops from the street to people. I mean, that's the way it sounds. So the unions step up and say, hey, those are our members. We're here to protect their jobs. And they're going to oppose it. So anything that's done is looked at as a constriction. You know, like by saying you can't use a chokehold, what if somebody has me in a chokehold and I have to put them in one? Well, you know, that's an absurd example of how this is being applied, at least being portrayed. What they're not willing to do is step up and work with the leadership of police departments and public officials to change policy, to change training, to build a different kind of police department, because it admits that if they agree to that, it admits that the current one has flaws, and they're not going to admit anything's wrong. That's why they want to fight this 50A repeal. They don't want everybody to see how discipline is meted out, and they don't want to let the public know the results of internal affairs investigations. The only time we find out about those is when cops get fired and it comes up in a civil suit, or when it gets leaked to the press. Thank goodness somebody has the good sense to make it public.
Rosemary, you touched on this about Joe Biden, and I just want to make sure that I have your point correctly. And just reading from the Washington Post, Biden's deep relationship with police groups while crafting the landmark 1994 legislation reflected his decades-long partnership with them as he embraced a tough-on-crime persona, one that extended from his time in the Senate to his work as vice president when he served as a liaison between police and the White House. But now, as Biden runs for president amid a national reckoning over police violence and racial injustice, that long alliance is threatening to undermine a cornerstone of his candidacy. But if I'm hearing you correctly, you're saying yes, but that was at that time he was doing what probably was right.
Name me one national leader who was not friendly with or working with police. I find it very similar to Hillary Clinton getting blamed for working with Wall Street when there was no politician of her era who would think of going into national level politics without working with the people who had money. But times change and people have to change, and I think Biden is adjusting. I think you're going to see it. We're on this panel. I'm embracing some of the ideas, the economic ideas that Bernie pushed so hard. He's right, and it's connected to the kind of political and police social justice issues that we're seeing now. It all is connected, and different thinking is required. So more power to him for doing that, and I can't blame him. But there's nothing bad about working with police if you think that people are in danger. You want safety on the streets. How is that a bad thing? It has not worked out because now it's swung too much the other way. Police have way too much power. They are just not scrutinized the way they should be. 50A, so obscure, and yet it prevents journalists, for example, from taking a look at how disciplined cops are handled in an area. It's the same as the Catholic Church, who didn't let anyone know what was happening with disciplined priests.
Right.
Who couldn't follow them, and so the abuse continued. You have to throw sunlight on this, and that means breaking the power of the police unions. It means demilitarizing them. It means taking away some of their funds. No longer can police departments count on saying, we need this much money, and they're going to get it. The money's going to be thrown at them. No more.
And Alan, you said it for a long time that politicians evolve, and that's what we're seeing with Joe Biden here.
Absolutely. It's sort of like the tides. They come in and they go out. There are times you need to help the police, and now is the time we need to help them. How? By making sure that they are as good as they can get. And by the way, that means personnel checks when they're recruited. It means how much education they have to have.
Right.
Look, even in my small town of Great Barrington, if there's a domestic dispute, the cops go in to handle it. You know what I'm talking about? They bring somebody with
right.
them now, apparently a social worker. But they have to have a comprehensive, and I believe, liberal arts training in order to do that. And for the most part, they don't.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We have a ton of letters, and I want to get to as many as we possibly can. They're very good and bring up many questions to the topics that we've been discussing this morning. Alan Chartok, Mike Spain, Rosemary Armeo, and Jennifer Burns make up the panel. We'll continue with your letters right after this break. Okay, you can just see that scene in Beverly Hills Cop, right? Of the cigarette truck going down the street. Okay. Very cool. Neutron Dance. Bonnie Pointer, we lost yesterday, 69 years old, founding member of the Pointer Sisters. And again, you can see the playlist, WAMC.org/roundtable. Okay, back to the conversation and to the letters. We have a ton of letters, and I don't even think I'm exaggerating. Bob says, good morning. Here's an idea for using the current protest movement's energy for big change. How about demanding that the federal government designate the KKK as a terrorist organization? I'm guessing that would get pretty close to unanimous support in Congress, which would make it impossible for Trump to ignore. Anyone on that? Jennifer, what do you think?
Yeah, go ahead, please, Jennifer.
I think that's a wise idea. Because that's exactly, what is helping to support the white power structure in the country through social intimidation
and terror. I mean, it goes back to also why it has taken over 120 years to get, you know, a lynching bill passed in this country, you know. So I absolutely think they're a terrorist group because they are not just terrorizing and killing African-Americans and other, you know, black, brown people and other minorities, but they're also terrorizing white people as well who do not agree with change.
120 years, that's stunning, yes.
Yes, and by the way, isn't it still hasn't gone through the Senate, has it?
The lynching bill.
The lynching bill, yeah, because of one guy.
Rand Paul.
Rand Paul saying nothing doing. Can you imagine nothing doing? That is unbelievable.
Daniel writes, panel, defund is terrible messaging if what it means is cut funding and radical reform. Defund means no funding, which is not what a majority of people are calling for. How about reform police now or cut the police? The slogan matters. The messaging matters. What is done under the messaging will be done.
Damn good letter.
Let's see. We go to Paul, who says, as usual, Rosemary gets it right. And may I add, to get meaningful change, the police need to be scared. The best way to scare a public body is to threaten its funding. I don't know. Should the police be scared, Rosemary?
Not by defunding, because I think they still own the politicians. We're kind of demonstrating that today with talking about Biden. But I think they should be afraid of the people. These are unbelievable protests. And let's not forget what happened in Minneapolis. As those men were killing George Floyd, a 17-year-old girl had the courage to videotape it and then to put it up on the air. And people were yelling at him, man, you're killing him. Stop it. Stop it. So I hope that they're afraid of the outrage of the citizens they're supposed to be serving.
I think I think it's appropriate, isn't it, for them to be scared? I mean, everybody should be scared. Professors should be scared. Everybody should.
No, that's true.
In terms of being outrageous.
Of what the future is.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mike?
Well, no, I worry that this whole idea that the police should be scared. We don't want the police intimidated by the public because of all this. We want to support the many, many, many good people in police departments. In my city, in Schenectady, my police chief got down on one knee and embraced the protesters. And that's happening all over the country. And there's a lot of police who work well with the community. There's people who come from the community. There's policemen of color, police officers of color who are integral in the community and trusted. And they should be affirmed that the kind of policing that is being done in some places is the right kind of policing. And in every city and municipality, you're right, Alan, even in little Great Barrington. I mean, they're the people that come when there's an emergency. There's an unattended death, a domestic dispute, some kind of a problem in a home or in a business. And we need them. And it sounds like we're at war with police. And that is a very bad message to get out there. We're at war with bad cops.
Mike, that's mighty true. Great Barrington to you. Go ahead.
That's true. Except I want to just say there is something else here. We have to understand about the thin blue line. You know, we have somebody said it yesterday on the panel. Serpico lives among us.
Right.
He does.
Yeah, great Malcolm guy. Made that point. Yep.
Malcolm
Nance,
right.
Yeah, great guy. And I've talked to Serpico many times. He's a very decent fellow, but he still has that bullet in his brain because he broke that line. When you say we have people of color, we do, and it's absolutely true. But until we say, okay, we're going to set up a system where everybody has a voice and nobody has to go along without severe recrimination, then we're really beginning to talk.
Carrie writes this letter.
No, I'm not going to back down from that. I want police to think every time that they go after somebody in a chase, in a car or a hand-to-hand combat, which is really what happened to George Floyd, yes, they should be afraid that this could turn out in a way that will be bad for me and for my force.
Well, you don't think you're arguing with us, do you? You don't think you're
about it. Why not let... Say George Floyd absolutely did what he was supposedly accused of, and he passed a bad money, and he counterfeited it. Let him go. He could have been arrested later. Same for any person that has been Trayvon Martin. That's ridiculous. That was a case what we were talking about where the law was just bad. But Castile, Philando, all of them, just let them go. That much better than insisting that they be arrested and you end up in a death.
Or shooting them.
And they should be afraid of that.
Or shooting them when they're running away.
But, Alan, to your point, no one was arguing that, right? I mean, no,
I wasn't arguing that.
Can I throw something out here?
Absolutely.
Because I think we have to watch our language when we talk about it, because one of the things that's happening when you see this reaction, or what people would say overreaction, and then the killing of black people, is that officers are already operating scared. And that may be influenced a lot by racial stereotypes and all of those things. And when officers are scared, like any people in society, they will act on that fear.
Yeah.
And so that is part of what's fueling this, you know, killing of black and brown people at the hands of the police, because within the culture, they are afraid of these big black bodies. And I'm going to put it that way.
You know,
I don't think anybody
really
is disagreeing.
And militarizing them doesn't help. Putting them behind big shields and batons and padded suits does not decrease the idea that you're at war with the community.
But I'll tell you,
and that really increases the movement to act, because now you are armed and ready to go into that war.
Right.
So those thoughts in your mind,
but
when you're scared, kick it in worse.
But I'll tell you what would help. The way you recruit cops will help. What you find out about who they are, what their natural predispositions are, right? I mean, in the end, it has to do with who the police are and what their character is, and whether we are attempting to find the right people and the people to do this job.
You know, I just to Jennifer's very good point. I think that when we're using the word scared in two ways.
We are.
One of course is that as a body, as a unit, that the police are worried about their funding, so that they will act more properly and be more in line, because there is a concern that their departments could be cut. As we said, a lot of people will feel like that during this time, that they're concerned about their jobs as so many cuts come into play, which is different than the police officer on the force feeling scared and intimidated by, yes, a black and brown person, and then taking that action. And as Rosemary says, in this like riot gear on top of it. Carrie makes a good point, too. We can't forget that women depend heavily on the police for protection against domestic abusers. What is the track record of the police in general on the response to domestic violence calls? Rosemary, any idea on that?
Well, I don't know what he means by record. Police don't like those cases. It's very dangerous for them to get involved in them. And really, is that the best way to deal with domestic violence? I think that mental health and social workers do a better job at it. And that does not mean that men get away with it. And I'm going to speak, yes, I don't want to hear from the people who say women are abusers too. Overwhelmingly, it's men abusing women. And it doesn't mean that men should not be accountable and go to jail for it, but you call in the police then at a particular time. If someone's got a gun and is threatening his family, then yes, you have to get police involved. But that domestic abuse doesn't begin that way. It begins in other problems. And we don't have any kind of centers, any kind of help for people in these situations ahead of time.
But the rules that should The rules are changing. You know, at this stage of the game, first of all, some police departments, I think mine does here in Great Barrington, they bring a social worker with them when they go into a domestic dispute. And secondly, if there is somebody who's there, seems to be, I don't know how extensive this is, but there does seem to be an idea that if somebody's an abuser, you remove them from the home, at least temporarily, until it can be adjudicated. And that's something that didn't happen in the old days.
Well, and if you're living next door in an apartment and you hear yelling and screaming and hitting and children, you're going to call the police, right?
I mean, and you should,
right? I mean, that's a common thing to think, and something that you would want them to respond to.
And I would certainly
want. Why are we talking about domestic abuse just because of the letter? I mean, the actual abuses seem to be in traffic stops and minor misdemeanors like selling loose cigarettes and passing bad money.
I think it came up, Rosemary, because of Alan's, I think it's a very good point, which is, you know, when we talk about less police officers, you know, there's a reason that we have the police. There's a reason that we have police departments and these everyday things that they do indeed, why you want them there in a time of need. Uh-huh.
And we're also talking about it because somebody wrote a letter about it. That's why we're talking about it.
Yeah.
Sure.
Letters.
All right, let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We have Alan Chartok, Mike Spain, Rosemary Armeo, Jennifer Burns, and your phone call. Not phone calls. God knows we don't want those. We want your letters. Panel@WAMC.org. Panel@WAMC. We know you're lovely and we love to talk to you, but let's do it via email. Panel@WAMC.org. We'll be right back.
Support for
Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Alan Chartok, Mike Spain, Rosemary Armeo, and Jennifer Burns. We welcome your letters. Panel@WAMC.org. We have many, many letters, and we will get to them. Here we go. Beverly says, if there are so many good police men and officers and good apples, why aren't they speaking up when they see something wrong happening? Jennifer.
Well, I would say it's because of the pressure that is put on them within that system. We're talking about police unions and things like that. If they are, say, the leak, they will be penalized, punished, at least, you know, pushed out and ostracized and perhaps not protected anymore by the police unions and fellow officers, you know, out of fear of, you know, being punished. So they walk a very fine line of trying to do their jobs, but also record and recognize that there are problems internally. And in some cases, their hands are tied because they will face a job loss or ostracization because of it. So I think that's a big part of it, that pressure within the system itself on them.
Melissa writes and says, I'm wondering what the panel's thoughts are on the following. Doctors are required to have a license to practice medicine. You can lose this license in the event they mess up. Lawyers have a license to practice law, and in the event they do not hold up to a certain standard, they are disbarred. Would it be possible to have police officers licensed to enforce the law? If they are deemed unfit, they lose their license and are no longer able to be an officer of the law.
Well, I mean, essentially they... Yeah, well, go ahead. I'm sorry, Rosemary.
I was just going to say, Mike, and you can add on to this. There's a lot of discussion about recurrent education. Doctors and nurses and other people in public service jobs have to go back every year for retraining and recertification. Do we require that of police? And, of course, it's all done at the local level. So the answer is some do and some don't.
Mike?
Yeah, no, that's right. And certain places, it's a lot easier to fire a bad cop than it is in other places. And a lot of that has to do with union contracts and civil service law, which, I mean, there are laws and unions do protect the rights of individuals. They can't be targeted if there's politics in a particular department or agency. But it may be the pendulum needs to swing back so that police officers need to be constantly trained and reassessed, and those who fail by their behavior or their inability to embrace the new ways of policing need to be weeded out of departments. But generally speaking, that kind of thing goes on in all professions, and police should be subject to the same kind of standards. Whether it's a license or not doesn't really matter.
Russ, you know what? Go ahead.
You know what? Easier said than done.
You get
a small town, you get a number of policemen, you know, they got friends and relatives and everything else. So go figure that you're going to be able to do that. You know, I hate to cite Law and Order as an academic reference, but I will anyway. At one point, Lenny arrests another officer. They find the guy who did it, and he opens up his drawer, and there's a rat in it. I think it is in fact a matter of culture. You endanger us all if you find anybody responsible for any wrongdoing whatsoever. It's very hard to find a chief of police who's going to buck that. It's very hard to insist on a disciplined force that ignores that thin blue line.
Russ writes to us and says it was jarring to hear the term break the union earlier. Police unions are unusual in that they have bipartisan support. Republicans went over police unions because of their strong on crime messaging, and Democrats will not say anything against the police unions because they are strong on unions, no matter how many times Republicans are supported by police unions. This suggests that the problem of accountability will not be solved unless there is bipartisan will to do so. Rosemary?
Yeah, excellent.
Don't forget that.
No. No, with great temerity, I would disagree with Rosemary. Look, politicians are, you know, are predictable. If they see the wind blowing in one way, they're going with it. And that we are seeing that, and we are seeing that right now. The same people who would have been real chicken to do anything are now, they can't wait to get over the next body in order to be out front on this.
You're so right.
That's true. Why did you say before you don't think McConnell will move the reform bill in the Senate?
Well, McConnell is holding on for dear life. You know, he's got an opponent who could win. Unbelievably, the opponent is running.
What Republican do you see? What Republican do you see who is evolving or moving?
Well, of course, we know about Mitt Romney, and he's done a magnificent job. He's a current hero of mine.
Black Lives Matter hasn't said anything about police reform. We're talking about unions and changing.
Yeah. What do you think about in the House, Rosemary? Aren't there members that are speaking out?
Oh, yeah, there are.
Republicans?
Well, that's a good point, because they have nowhere to go, Rosemary. They've got a leader who is saying, I'm the law and order guy. And they know that if they go with the Democrats, who needs them?
That may be my favorite Trump impression.
Vince. Letter writer, bipartisan support, forget about it.
You know, I think Alan's right, though, that politicians moisten their finger, put it up, and see which way the wind is blowing, and they go that way. I mean, too often. And this may happen.
You know, we would try really hard on this show generally to not make a big deal or bring up a lot of the president's tweets. But, you know, sometimes they just make your head explode. And so this one from an hour ago, help me, folks, please help me. I will read it as written. Buffalo protester shoved by police could be an Antifa provocateur. 75-year-old Martin Gugino was pushed away after appearing to scan police communications in order to black out the equipment. What? At OANN, which is, you will remember, is the One America News Network, which is a conservative news outlet, that he has their tag in there. I watched. He fell harder than was pushed. Was aiming scanner, could be a setup, question mark? Anyone want to help me read that one?
Yeah, Joe Scarborough murdered his aide back in 2000.
Oh, Jesus.
Okay. Or something like that. You know what I mean? It's a completely bogus.
Don't forget Ted Cruz, whose father assassinated Kennedy.
That's true. Ridiculous. Yeah. And Obama was born in Kenya.
But I don't even understand what we're talking about. And I know it doesn't matter. Please don't write letters. I know it doesn't matter. But I don't even know what he's talking about when he says, in order to black out the equipment, was aiming scanner. If those things were said to you as you were getting out of your car on Central Avenue and walking to work, you would just walk quicker and get to the door.
It suggests that this 75-year-old guy had some sophisticated electronic equipment that was scrambling police communications, and then he feigned his fall to the ground and smashed his own head into the pavement so that his body bled and his blood came out of his ears. That's what it suggests.
That is some pretty good. Yeah, that's a good Trump to English to Trump dictionary entry. Mike Spain, good for you. Alan?
Well, from the Department of Sarcasm, it is unbelievable to me that this kind of nonsense comes from the mouth of the President of the United States.
Well, exactly.
It's unbelievable.
And so, Jennifer...
Actually, Trump may be right. We need stronger libel and slander laws so that the guy in Buffalo could take advantage of them.
So, yeah. Jennifer, how do you, I mean, how do you even combat that, you know, academically, intelligently combat that kind of, and I'm using this word incredibly loosely, logic?
I have to admit that sometimes you can't.
Yeah.
I mean, it is so out there that you will get lost in the weeds trying, you'll spend all your time trying to figure out how to, you know, talk about each one of those components in there, when each one of the things that he wrote in there gets more, you know, it's just lunacy.
Yeah.
It's something to say to distract people, to get them running, to get them thinking, and to get them looking in a different direction than really where the problem lies.
And while we're on the subject, the fact that this president, who won't wear a mask, who has led us very late into the coronavirus protection, he's now going to open up to those rallies, which he thinks is his only way out, and have thousands of people sitting there potentially infecting each other. Unbelievable.
Well, and moving out the Republican convention out of North Carolina.
Him blame the protests for any uptick that we may and are likely to see in COVID in the coming weeks. He's going to blame it on protests.
Mm-hmm.
And not on the opening of the economy.
And not on his and not on his putting thousands of people into a stadium together to applaud him.
And what he's doing through his campaigning is creating a reverse protest.
Right.
Right? I mean, yes. That's what he's doing.
Sure, sure. But right now, look where he is. The numbers keep going down, and they are, and he's trying desperately to figure out what it is. So he goes back to the point where he was making some hay, and he says, well, when I was allowed to have these groups of people together cheering me on, I was doing better, so I have to go back to that, even if it's going to kill people.
And meanwhile, global coronavirus caseload numbers are increasing. 7 million, the WHO warning that the pandemic appeared to be worsening and that asymptomatic transmission was not a significant factor in how the virus spreads. As the global caseload surges past 7 million, the WHO has issued a warning. And the organization's director general told reporters that more than 100,000 new cases had been reported on 9 of the previous 10 days, and that Sunday's tally, 136,000 cases, was the highest single-day tally so far. The pandemic has sickened more than 7 million people worldwide, according to a New York Times database. As of Tuesday morning, at least 405,000 people had died, and the virus had been detected in nearly every country. And of course, these numbers are especially high here in the United States. So, Mike,
well,
what do we do with that? Yes.
Well, I mean, it's important to realize that as New York City, and it's a wonderful thing that New York City is beginning to reopen very carefully and very in a very limited way, but it's a symbol of after 100 days of hunkering down and doing the right thing, you know, progress is happening. But in some countries, in Central America and South America, in Africa and other underdeveloped countries, this is just beginning to take off. The what happened in Italy before it came to the U.S. is now happening in other capitals, and it's not going away. And evidently, it's scary. I mean, the WHO experts are saying now that you know, if you have asymptomatic COVID-19, in other words, you don't have any of the symptoms, but you can give it to others, they're not so worried about that now. But they're also saying that the belief that the warm weather was going to alleviate a lot of this and maybe get rid of it, that doesn't look like it either. I mean, we're just learning more about this. It's going to be around a while, and it's continuing to be a worldwide threat.
And remember when every news story was about the vaccine about to come on the scene.
Right.
You're hearing a lot less about that right now.
Yeah.
I mean, there's hope about a vaccine, absolutely. But I mean, many experts still say by the time you fully test and promulgate a vaccine across the globe, it's a couple years, you know.
And Rosemary, meanwhile, we see numbers rising in this country, and the governor of New York who we'll be hearing from at 11:30 this morning as well, you pointed out yesterday that those numbers, especially in states that reopened and reopened quickly, are definitely seeing spikes.
Yeah, they are. So, you know, again, I've been saying this consistently. I think it's time for personal responsibility. If you're going out, I go out sparingly, always have a mask. I think twice before I bring my elderly mother. And I think everybody has to do that. Instead, I'm seeing things on social media like protesters in Columbus, Ohio, who are screaming at a reporter who's reporting in a mask. You work for a company and you're lying. You're trying to scare people. You know you're doing it. There's such how health became a part of the culture war. Blame that on Trump, too. And that is going to kill people. You can say the beaches are closed, but people still go. You have to take personal responsibility or you're going to get sick.
And what about all the anti-vaxxers? We've heard from them, and we have certainly heard from them again and again about exposing other people's children because they don't want to vaccinate their own.
Right, and what happens when we start, Jennifer?
Oh no, I was just agreeing. I mean, we've known from the beginning that there was going to be, or we were told, a second wave, at least. Yeah. Sure. When things began to reopen, which is why we have these, 2-week plans and 2-week sessions and counting our numbers. But we do have to remember that this is also going to be the first wave and then the second wave in other countries around the world. So it's going to continue to circulate. I can't understand why it's so problematic and tough to understand that.
Right. When you have the president, and I'm going to go to the president's press conference in Maine, where he went after the governor, and why isn't your state open, and why are you doing this, and why are you falling for this line, and we're fine, and it's hard to...
And there are only going to be 15 cases in all of the United States. Remember that one?
That was one of the first comments. Right. Yeah.
I mean, this is much worse. We usually have the flu season, right? And we talk about this, and then it spreads, and... This is far bigger and worse. And people believe in the flu season, not that everybody goes and gets vaccinated and all that, but this is bigger and this is global. So why don't more people believe it is puzzling to me.
And the point, too, Mike, that I thought the governor made very well yesterday, he's been making it right along, is that the reason that New York City was able to start reopening yesterday and the reason that parts of the state are even getting ready later this week, possibly for phase three, is because people were doing what they were told. People were doing the right thing.
That's exactly right. And I think that is the correct way to look at it. Unfortunately, because it hasn't spiked in certain areas, like in rural counties of New York or rural places and just different places around the U.S., people are saying, see, it really wasn't a threat after all. But the reason it didn't spike was because people took personal responsibility, just as Rosemary was saying. Don't stop.
Yeah, I mean, if you're afraid, you take responsibility. I think also some of this is just the nature of science and medical reporting. It's like, is it safe to drink coffee? Well, this study says yes, this study says no, this study says it depends on how much. We're seeing the same thing with coronavirus. If you're asymptomatic, you can spread it. No, you don't. We're going to need ventilators. No, we don't. And it feels to people who want clear, precise, make America great slogans, it's complicated, and they feel like they're just being jerked around, and so they withdraw. And it's easier to succumb then to the president who is saying, well, it's over now, we're over the worst, let's get the economy back on track. That's a very appealing message. Much
it is very appealing.
But you don't, I agree with you 100%, Rosemary, absolutely. But, the facts are that you have 7.1 million cases, and you have at least 400,000 deaths worldwide.
Well, I mean, I listened to it again about the flu. We believe in the flu because we have had it ourselves or we know somebody who did. My son had it. My mother had it. But I don't know anyone who's had COVID. So, yeah, it's easy to see it as something far away and not affecting me. It still is, despite the large number.
Really? Now, see, I know...
That's... Yeah.
I don't know. I know 4 people who have had it. I know 1 person who passed away from it. I just don't, I think that's going to change too. We're here in New York. I mean, I just think that is going to...
Yeah. in upstate New York, where it's, so I mean, you are gonna regard it differently. The threat, you're gonna regard it differently than I do. Yeah. It seems abstract to me. It's very real to you.
When pollsters do the surveys about how people feel about this, they'll ask, "Do you know anybody personally who's had it? Do you know anybody who's died?" And the answers change. But do you know anybody who's lost their job? Have you lost your job? Has your income suffered? And when they ask it that way, you begin to understand just what you're saying. Yeah.
Chuck writes and says, "My brainwashed brother." So I'm thinking Chuck has a typical sibling relationship. Chuck says, "My brainwashed brother told me 2 days ago that the elderly gentleman had potentially a weapon inside his phone like James Bond. So sad," says Chuck.
That man is a well-known agitator or activist, I would say, for elderly issues. He's known in New York State. He's known in Albany County. It's just all craziness.
You know what I think? I think he got too close to the cops. That was it. And this is all post hoc to propter hoc, as Cuomo used to say, trying to make up stuff about what it was, when in fact they were just threatened by the fact that this unarmed man walked close to them.
Right. But, you know, you do. I mean, I don't care how old he is, but you don't throw a 75-year-old guy down on the ground and leave him. I mean, that's just, that was what was so.
And I can only
it's
tell
the other
from
cops
office
who passed right by.
Yeah, exactly.
But doesn't that even come back to, like, the idea of training?
Yes.
And
yes.
also
yes.
the procedures that you proceed through. You push the line or you do those sort of things. So in this case, these officers did that, and it was too much force.
Right.
Well, not only right, so training, again, Jennifer, character. It's all about character. Are you predisposed to believe that somebody of color is going to do you harm?
Well, yeah, but I'm talking about in the case of Buffalo.
Yeah, in the
right?
case
He's
of...
an older
yeah.
white man.
Oh, yeah, that's true. And by the way, he's not that old. That's not so
old.
Well,
no, I didn't say old.
Compared to me.
It's a relative term.
A whippersnapper he is.
Right?
But,
you know, this is how you secure the line. This is the way you move right. forward. This is the way you right. do it.
And in that right. video, I think there was...
Professor, that's true. I think the procedure there was if somebody's down, you call a medic and you keep moving. And their orders were to push that line back, and that's what they did, by golly, despite someone bleeding. They called a medic and they figured that was their duty. And I think the rules are set up that way. You are right.
Mike?
And so that right there needs to be changed. Those procedures right off the front, those laws. And then you can protect officers. Right?
Well,
if something
you certainly...
like that happens.
Mike, I heard you sigh. Go ahead.
I mean, you certainly want officers to be trained and enlightened, and you want to enlighten them that the best way to, on the best ways to behave and to manage situations like that when they sort of break the book a little bit. And if they're not going to be enlightened, yes, then you want them to know the whole world is watching, you're on camera, and if you screw this up, you're going to pay dearly. You know, one or the other, whichever
that,
works
that
to get
being
them to
afraid
do the right
by
thing.
The public and being accountable. Doesn't this remind you of Abu Ghraib when we had soldiers in Iraq and they went into a prison
Rosemary, I gotta
and
take
they
a...
just tortured and tormented people?
I just
and,
have to... Rosemary, I just have to
and
take
then,
a break.
And then we said, oh, we have to train them.
We'll
I'm
be back
sorry.
Right after this.
Shut me up?
Yes, but that's okay. We'll be right back. If I was on the stand, I would say I was not trying to shut Rosemary up. I was simply trying to get to a break. You were talking about Abu Ghraib, which I think was an interesting comparison. Please go on, Rosemary.
Yeah. In that case, we had a bunch of military guys who took over a prison and tortured and mistreated Arab prisoners. And in the aftermath, when no officials but all the lower-level people were punished for it, we said, oh, they weren't trained. They needed to learn how to do this. They were just thrown into a situation they didn't know. And my response then is the same as now. Really, you need training to respond to a bleeding elderly man on the sidewalk? Isn't it human decency? You really need a class in that? You need some sort of sensitivity. If you don't have that sensitivity to begin with, why are you a cop?
Hmm. That's a great point. I think that's what, Jennifer, you were alluding to that earlier, right? I mean, it's what you, of the expectation, so you change what those quote-unquote rules are, right?
Yeah, I mean, we have to change the laws and the procedures that police officers are following and trying to enforce.
And,
right? Because, go ahead, Alan.
I was just going to say, and I think Rosemary's question was right to the heart of it. Why are you a cop?
Yeah.
There are lots of reasons people become police, and some of them really are terrible.
Justin writes to us and says, I hate reading Trump's tweets, but I do have a tip for you that makes them a little more palatable that I thought I'd share. As I read them, I imagine an old man on a bus stop saying his words verbatim to a rat that is sitting on his knee. It sounds much more appropriate in that context than it does coming from the President of the United States. I hope this helps. I would say, Justin, yes, yes, it does.
And I would say, I've said it 1,000 times, I say it one more time. How did we get here?
Yeah.
How did we get this guy?
Well, and yeah, and we've all, I mean, we touched on this last week too, Rosemary, but you know, this is, this is all a lot worse than any of us even imagined, isn't it?
I thought it would be bad, but I never in a million years thought it would be this bad.
All right.
I agree, but I want to say one thing.
Yes.
If Mike Pence were saying was the president and was saying the same stuff that that Trump is saying now, let's say he succeeded to the presidency and had the same program, would we be saying, you know, how outrageous it is? No, because the guy is outrageous. And I'm not saying that his policies are any good. They stink. But it is his craziness that's getting everybody.
Right. Right. But Mike Pence wouldn't do that, right? I mean, Mike Pence wouldn't write that tweet that we read this morning.
He certainly wouldn't do it with a woman in the room.
Kim says, if I'm not mistaken, New York State law is that it is felony assault to assault anyone over 65 years of age when the assailant is at least 10 years younger. It seems to me the Buffalo police assault on the 75-year-old gentleman fits squarely into that definition. Philip says, if good cops don't report bad behavior, all the apples are bad, period. Ellen says, I don't entirely agree with the focus on bad cops. The way I see it, there is a huge difference in the way policing is done in black communities from the much more civil approach to policing in white communities. Why whites support police is they don't experience the fear of police that blacks feel. Whites look at police as protecting them and so will not support defunding police. I want a serious look at the reason why police feel that they can and should treat black men, women, and even children differently than whites. If policing in all communities were the same, with people in black neighborhoods treated with respect and decency, police could feel safe calling the police. Now a call to the police by a black person is as likely to result in their death instead of help. Jonathan says, as in most cases with in our society and government, the police would be greatly improved if we simply had more women officers. Too much testosterone ends up ratcheting up arguments in our streets and in our government halls of power. Anything, Jennifer, any thoughts on that?
I would say that there is some truth to hearing more and accepting the leadership of women, because they have a education and they have experience across the country in different communities that can add some significant information needed to revamp and shift laws and policies and funding and childcare and other things like that, that often men are not asked to focus on or to juggle.
Rosemary?
I think there's something to that. For one thing, George Floyd would still be alive today. Females don't have the same, even with all their militarized equipment, they don't have the same physical strength, and so they rely on other methods of conflict resolution. Men can learn this and should learn this, but I think women more naturally come to it. Yeah, I think it's good. I like seeing police women.
Beverly writes, it is my understanding that you can't make major changes without first breaking the police union contracts by ending the department. Then you can rebuild it in another way. And what you do in the meantime, though, right, Alan?
Yeah, I mean, from the very beginning, I've been talking about not defunding, but reforming, and reforming big time. When I worked for the police commissioner in New York, I remember His big thing was to get cops to shed some weight. He thought that they were all too fat. And he, you know, because they had to be in better tip-top shape, and he couldn't get to first base with that. Now we're talking about basic attitudinal change? Wow.
David writes, police should only solve crimes. The number one deterrent to crime is that you will be caught, caught quickly, and punished. All the other deterrents, quote-unquote, that police have been asked to do, they fail at. We got this from Stephanie, who says, reality is that reallocation of police funds is often limited in cities and towns across the country. Selection of police officers is one of the things that has to be fixed. That, absolutely. Alan, to your point.
Yep.
NPR, Bob said, carried a piece yesterday regarding Camden, New Jersey, and their complete restructuring of their police department. It could serve as a model during the calls for defunding stemming from recent tragic events.
You know, this economic crisis we're in because of the coronavirus is going to cause a lot of municipalities to slash their municipal budgets, and police departments are threatened by that. They're going to be probably receiving cuts also, just like the Department of Public Works and the Parks Department and all that kind of stuff. And now is the time to be thinking how restructuring can take advantage, well, I don't want to say take advantage of that, but how they can use this forced reduction that is thrown upon us by the bad economy to look for ways. Criminal justice experts have all kinds of solutions. They've studied this academically, and they've seen it work in many places. I mean, there are solutions to dealing with smaller police departments. And now it's kind of, unfortunately, because of a terrible reason, maybe it's the time to figure it out.
Ruth writes, it has always amazed me how Democrats encompass the harmful Republican tags like Obamacare and now defunding police. There is no denying Republicans' ability to coin the ugliest of phrases. The problem is how the Democrats and the media accept and adopt those phrases. Josh says, how do we... Go ahead, Rosemary.
True.
You agree?
Okay. That's really true. Messaging is just ridiculous. Mike spoke about that earlier. It's death panels all over again.
Josh writes, how do we hold people accountable at work? Their paycheck. So we need to hold police accountable by using their paychecks. Yes, we need to find a way to reform with every point of view involved, but you have to aim for the moon in order to even make incremental change.
And that goes right to unions, I'll tell you right now.
Yep.
That's what that's about.
And can I add in here?
Of course.
You know, the letter you had a few minutes ago about the police reform in Camden, New Jersey?
Yes.
That was really launched because of a funding deficit in the city, right? So they were running out of money to fund the police. And so they looked at these other creative solutions. And it has become a really successful model there. And they take on the partnership policing rather than that kind of, you know, to what we have happening all over the country.
Jennifer, as always, your point is extremely well taken. I'll tell you right now, we're about to face that kind of a fiscal pandemic across New York and maybe across the whole country, in which the states are all starving. They don't have the money they need and to give it out. They can give it to education, as they always have, or they can give it to police, as they always have. But they can't give it to both. And that may be an answer, that you take advantage of something like this in order to restructure.
It was a really good piece last night where NPR's Mary Louise Kelly spoke with Scott Thompson, who is a former chief of police in Camden. And it's about, as the letter earlier said, about the city's effort to build a new police force from scratch. And all of that came out of Camden's homicide rate being through the roof, scores of excessive force complaints. So the mayor and the city council dissolved the police force and created a new one. And they were looking in this piece, which is on our website, if you just put in Camden, NPR WAMC, it'll come right up. But it's interesting because it does look at what they were able to do. And one of, I'm sure, many models that'll be looked at over the coming weeks, months, and years.
It'll be resisted, though.
Of course.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, you know, people will say,
aren't all
you
good
can
ideas?
Turn off the water, you can close the pools, you can do everything else, but don't take police off the streets. We'll be unsafe. I mean, there will be a lot of people who embrace that mentality.
Linda says administering a comprehensive personality inventory test to prospective police applicants would eliminate sociopaths. Gary says, my little rural New York county receives tens of thousands of dollars of Homeland Security money annually to buy paramilitary equipment and training for a relatively small sheriff's department. I have to admit, in watching some of the videos in these little towns across the country of the equipment they have, man. And this little county next to us gets the same, and the next one to that. By now, any one of us could take out ISIS single-handedly. So defund the police-to-be means stop this paramilitary Homeland Security money and use it for something that serves and protects.
And we know that police dogs.
I also want to talk about police or prison guards. I don't want them defending the Capitol. I think there's something really wrong, and isn't that illegal? How did that happen? Who is in the prisons, and how did we strip out prison guards and put them in the streets in Washington?
Well, isn't that a bar question?
Yes.
Yeah.
The Attorney General bar.
Yeah, the Attorney General bar.
Alan, you can't go to bars yet, Joe.
I thought you meant the place where you drank.
No, different.
That would be a bar question
yes,
also.
Yes, that's and a bar trick, actually. Yes.
Right. if I had a point, I don't have it anymore.
And Barr doesn't, he has said many times he doesn't think that there's systematic racism within the criminal justice system.
Right.
Yes. That's his line.
So he's disconnected.
Yep. So we begin with that point. Right. Biden is right in his messaging with reform over defunding, says Kevin. If he sticks with it, that will help keep moderate voters. We go to Daisy, who says Joe Biden can pass plenty of reforms when he is elected and will do that, but he is smart not to jump on Trump's shiny object and start yelling defund the police. Again, we're lucky that he is our candidate. His moderation will help us navigate these waters.
Good letter.
Marvin says it's not about unions. Unions are good. Unions have an obligation to protect its union unit members no matter what. The problems have nothing to do with unions. You could get rid of all the unions, and incidents like that involved George Floyd would continue to happen. This goes deeper than that. We have post-slavery racist structures. What I am hearing from this panel is union bashing. We unfortunately only have a minute.
Point, and it does go deeper, but unions are part of the issue in the same way that car unions, the auto workers unions, was part of the problem that brought that industry low. When unions have a job to protect their workers, and sometimes that includes working with management, and the auto workers was not willing to do that. Here, the police unions have part of their duty is to work with the public, and they are not doing that. They have forgotten that part of their duties. So it's not bashing. I'm a big supporter of unions. I think they have brought about wonderful working conditions, such as we have them in the country. We've lost them in places where unions have deteriorated. But some of the blame is on the unions.
Rosemary, you get the last word today. We are out of time.
Yes.
My thanks to Alan, Mike, Rosemary, Jennifer. Thank you all very much. We'll be back with the Congressional Corner and later on Governor Cuomo at 11:30. Next.